Hello, everybody. I'm Robert, the Tech Doctor.
And I'm Allison Hartley. And
welcome to the Tech Doctor podcast. Well, that's our new introduction. I think we may work on it even more.
Just a bit.
Just a bit, but we gave it a shot. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing all right. How about you?
Doing good, thank you. Before we introduce our special guest for today, I wanted to make a couple very quick corrections to errors that I've made in a couple recent Tech Doctor podcasts.
You're slipping.
I am getting old, and I am slipping really, really badly. First one, in the Celebrating the Kindle Access podcast, I very proudly proclaimed that you can purchase books from the Amazon Kindle iOS app, but you cannot. You have to load up the Amazon Kindle store in Safari and buy your books that way. And the other thing I wanted to correct, just for the record, was you are absolutely right that the latest version of the Audible.com book reading app does work properly with the pause command with the Aftershocks Bluetooth headphones. So you need the latest version of that app. And most people, I think, have updated their apps to work with the Aftershocks Blues pause button, because this is a problem not just for it, but for a lot of Bluetooth headsets. A lot of them, for whatever reason, when you press the pause button, it just issues another play command to the software. And if your software isn't smart enough to know if it's already playing to pause when it sees a play command, then that's where you have the problem.
Oh, man.
So it's true for a lot of Bluetooth headsets. But a couple of them, like the Audible app and the Downcast app, had to be updated to get a little bit smarter in that regard. So I want to make those corrections. And, of course, you haven't made any mistakes.
Not yet.
No. Perfection.
I'm younger than you.
Of course. and that probably explains it right there, right?
Probably.
Okay. All right. Well, today we're excited to have with us a gentleman who has been around the access technology arena for a long time. I'm sure you all will realize in a moment that you've heard his name in various places, but I'm going to ask him to tell us a bit about what he does and who he is, so that we can get an idea of kind of the general things that are going on with this man, and then we're going to get into discussing a really exciting new book that he has just published. So I want to welcome Larry Lewis to the podcast. Larry, thanks for taking a little bit of your Sunday morning to record with us here, and we appreciate you being here. And take it away and tell us a little bit about yourself, if you will.
Well, thank you both for having me on the podcast. This is my very first time on the Tech Doctor podcast, and it's really great to be spending a little bit of my Sunday morning with you. So thanks for having me. I have been around in a few different capacities over the years. I really started my, entry into the adapt tech industry probably about 20 years ago. I accepted a position out of graduate school, working at the Cleveland Sight Center in a few different capacities, one of which was overseeing a lot of the speech and braille evaluations in their technology lab. I live up in Cleveland, Ohio, and have lived here for about 20 years. I thought I would be here only about a year or two and ended up putting down roots here and so on. After the stint at the Sight Center, I really made my move into the for-profit arena, and I worked with HumanWare for about 5 years and helped them with the initial launch of the Braille Note technology and a few other things, and had a great time with them. But it seems like every few years I have to do something differently. So I made a switch to another for-profit company, and I worked for them for about almost 4 years, Optelec, and did a number of things with them in regard to introducing some different types of things to the U.S. In regard to mobile technologies and so forth. Really about, I guess, seven years ago, I've always wanted to sort of command my own ship, do my own thing. And so I resigned from my position at Optelec, and I started Flying Blind LLC. And Flying Blind, in a nutshell, we do roughly four different types of things. We work with companies who are bringing out assistive technologies that might be a little smaller than your bigger companies. And we try to give them some guidance and some marketing and sales guidance, product positioning, and help get them into North America. The second thing that we do is we have a business development arm where we work with different for-profit and not-for-profit companies and help get them some different types of exposure and expand their scope of business. So we do a little bit of that. We do some professional development work, which is really the basis of where this book came from that we're going to be talking about in regard to working with education. My heart really is with the VI teacher, because I had a very special VI teacher in my life who really shaped who I am today in some respects more than my parents did. And then lastly, and probably leastly for this podcast, we do have a reselling arm where we sell both used and new equipment, high tech and low tech. I love to sell. I've loved to sell ever since I was a kid, be it lemonade to soda in college up to $10,000 braille displays. So I love to sell, and that'll never change. So why not make that a part of my business? So there's a sales component to what we do as well. So there's really four different things that we're involved in. It's great. You have to have the stomach for it, for sure, when you're not working for an employer and getting a paycheck every 2 weeks. But it's great. We get to sort of be involved with the things we want to do. And I joke with people and tell people that my business is recession proof. I picked the worst time ever to start a business, and that was before the bottom fell out of the market. And we managed to weather the storm in 2008, 2009, and it's turned around, and I couldn't be happier with it.
Does it help a lot that your business is as diversified as it is? I mean, you have a selling component, you have an educational component, you have the idea of bringing devices that are maybe somewhat lesser known into the U.S., as you said. I mean, that feels like fingers in a lot of different pies.
Especially with the volatility of things. I mean, there are big, I know this isn't what we're here to talk about, but there are big companies in this industry that are fighting to keep with it. So I think being involved in a number of things helps spread things around a little bit and gives you a few different legs to stand on. My only thing with diversification is you have to be focused. So, our mission, everything that we do kind of plays into our mission. We want to focus on technology being a way for those of us who are vision impaired to empower ourselves to participate in the classroom, the workplace, and in our community. And if any of those things that I'm involved in sort of goes back to that mission, we can keep our focus. You could be involved in a million different things, but if there's no focus to what you're doing, you're really not working very smart in the long run. So I think it's great to be diversified as long as you have a focus to what you're doing.
I don't know how much you can or will be able to say about this, Larry, but I can't resist asking you this after what you just said. Is it your feeling that some of the mainstream access technology companies are indeed struggling at this point?
Well, I think that we're shifting as an industry, and a lot of this is because of Apple and also, some of the things that Google is doing right now. I'm not saying anybody's going out of business, but I'm saying that when I was doing the big company thing, it was a commodities-based industry where you sold product. There might have been a little bit of hand-holding aside from your tech support that you have, and then you move on and you sell more product, you move on and you sell more product. That's changing a lot because of the devices that we're going to talk about today and so forth. And what we've determined is instead of kicking against these giant companies like Apple, why not shift our business model to not just be commodities oriented, but also service oriented? So I think these bigger companies, and I think you're seeing it a little bit with GW Micro and Freedom Scientific to some degree, they're starting to offer services, some of which you have to buy, but it's not about just selling hardware anymore. It's not about selling these real expensive pieces of hardware anymore when you have less costly solutions. So I think everybody, I think IS2 is also doing it a little bit. You have to think of different ways of providing service to this industry. And it's not always about commodities. There has to be some hand-holding, training, webcasts, those sorts of things to prop up a part of your business that I don't think is ever going to come back. I think even if there is money out there now, even if there is money out there like there might have been 10, 15, 20 years ago, you're not going to see states and school districts buying the crazy amounts of expensive technology that they were, because they don't have to anymore. And that's really one of the reasons I got involved in the whole iOS stuff, you know, kicking and screaming, because I'm one of those guys who used to sell lots and lots of expensive stuff.
Yeah.
So
so I would argue, and I would be curious whether or not you all would agree with me or not, but I would argue that at least a fairly significant reason that this paradigm has shifted the way that it has is because Apple came along and offered the voice over technology on all of its devices at no additional charge.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And when that happened, I think people began to realize that they had been paying a really big price for gaining access to their computer or their phone that they didn't really have to pay anymore if they decided to go with one of the Apple products.
I agree. I think you and I became acquainted, Dr. Carter, back when I was doing the mobile speak thing. And I think mobile speak for its time was great, and it still has some great, you know, things that's going on with Android or whatever. But at the time, it was really cool to be able to only pay $300. Now, how does that sound? We only pay $300 to get access to a $200 phone.
Yeah,
eight years ago, that was awesome. You know, wow, we only have to pay $300. Now that's unheard of. But I mean, now I'm like, what do you mean I got to pay $300?
Right, right, exactly. But the thing is, though, before mobile speak, the reason $300 sounded awesome was because we had paid $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 before
right.
that. And that's why $300 sounded good.
Right. And I can remember 3 years ago, it might have been a little over, it was when VoiceOver first came out. And it was good, but it wasn't where it was today. And I did a comparison between VoiceOver and MobileSpeak, and they were kind of neck and neck, where MobileSpeak still had the edge, but there was kind of like this groundswell that I saw where it's like, well, but as this keeps evolving, as they get Braille access and so forth, in a very joking around sense, I'll say, as Mitt Romney said, you know, you can't fight free.
Yeah.
It's like, what are you going to do if you've got something this good for free that performs this well? How are you going to compete with that?
Some people will argue, of course, that, you know, when you buy Apple products, you're paying a premium price for the product. And you are. Apple has never been shy about charging a healthy price for their hardware. But at least in my experience, at the present time, Apple is making the very best hardware out there right now.
I have to use my PC for a couple of, you know, just because I'm involved with corporate America and I do some work with the feds and so forth. But I do so much, as I know you both do, with between iCloud, Dropbox, Google Drive, that sort of thing. I do so much with my phone, and, you know, it's no secret, I'm a Braille guy, so I use a Braille display a lot of the time with my phone for extensive writing and editing or whatever. But I do so much with that, and it's so liberating not to have to lug around a PC and just to do things with my phone when I'm on a train or on a bus. Or, I mean, it is such a game changer that I never thought, you know, I go back like the both of you do, all the way back to the VersaBraille days. I never imagined this kind of access in my pocket.
Yeah, it is unbelievable, really. And honestly, I never imagined that we would have even touchscreen access. When the iPhone right. first came out, I thought, wow, that's too bad. Flat piece of glass and icons will never mean anything to me as a blind person. And I was so thrilled to have been proven wrong in 2009. You know, that was an awesome day. I guess what this does in some ways is kind of bring us naturally up to talking about your book, because obviously you have discovered the importance of iOS in the educational arena, and clearly there is a need for teachers and parents who are working with students with disabilities to understand iOS, in particular to understand the iPad, and to be able to teach it and its accessibility features to students. And so you have written a book, and I can't help but giving you a hard time because you're the only author we've had on the Tech Talk podcast so far that has not one, but two colons in the title of their book.
Yeah, I wasn't responsible for that. You can give the publisher a hard time about that.
Okay. Nevertheless, it's a really great book that I thoroughly enjoyed reading, and I'm looking forward to us talking in some detail about it. The book is called iOS Success, : Making the iPad Accessible, : A Guide for Teachers and Parents, by Larry Lewis. So if you don't mind, Larry, tell us a little bit about the process here. How did you get to the point of deciding to write such a book, and how did it all come together in the way that it did?
Well, the book, more or less, is a culmination of a day-long professional development seminar that we offer called, and we've named it the Apple Accessibility Initiative, and we call it AAI. And the way the Apple Accessibility Initiative came about was a couple of years ago, I was at a fairly large conference, and I was in the exhibit hall working for a supplier of mine that I do a little bit of work for. And this vision teacher, I would guess, you know, she was probably in her mid-20s, maybe second year out of school, very new into the industry, came over to me and asked if she could speak to me. And she was pretty much in tears. And I was kind of worried, like, what's going on? And she pulls me off to the side and she says, I have a first grader. And I have an administrator who I'm working with. I have this first grader who's visually impaired. She really can't read print very well, and she's going to need to learn Braille. And I have this administrator that says that we'll get you an iPad, and that's all she's going to need. I don't know how to use this device with her. I don't know how this plays into how she learns how to read and write. And she was completely, like, beside herself. I mean, so upset that it was just amazing. I was really moved by how much she cared about this kid and worried, how do I just use an iPad and nothing else? Because my administrator says that it's got everything you need. Apple says so. So I got to thinking about this, and I talked to her a little bit, and I gave her some direction. I said, well, you're going to need some other things too. It's just not simple as, you know, a sighted kid getting an iPad, and that's all they need. They're going to need pencil, paper, some other stuff to learn how to read and write. So we did talk about that, but that got me thinking, and I knew that if there was somebody like her out there, there was going to be a whole lot of people out there that just hadn't identified themselves to me. So we created this day-long workshop that I said was called the Apple Accessibility Initiative, and what it does is it unveils all of the access components to iOS with an emphasis on the iPad because, you know, while you and I may use iPhones because we're, you know, not print readers and the screen is smaller, as a rule, schools are buying iPads as sort of a general universal type thing for the sighted kid, the low vision kid, the blind kid, the kid with multiple impairments, the learning disabled. It's sort of the universal thing. So we wanted to keep iPad as the common denominator, not that it was the most appropriate thing for a blind person to use, but it's what the schools were buying.
I was just thinking that, you know, actually as a totally blind person, I use both an iPhone and an iPad. And it's true that the iPad is not just a larger iPhone.
True.
It is a different device. It has a lot of similarities to the iPhone, but the pop-ups that appear on screen and the way that it operates is different from the iPhone. And honestly, it's taken me a little while, again, as a totally blind person, to really embrace the iPad to the extent that I have embraced my iPhone. But I've gotten quite addicted to it in the last few months and really happy with reading books on it and doing different things on the iPad. And so I don't think it's a mistake necessarily that that schools are providing the iPad to blind and visually impaired students, maybe as opposed to the phone. But it certainly means a bit of a different learning curve, doesn't it?
It's a different learning curve, and I think I think this isn't too bold of a statement when I would say that you're probably, as an adult, I don't want to say an exception to the rule because more blind adults may, but I think the masses gravitate to the phone because it goes with them. I started with the iPad and got the phone afterwards. So I started with the iPad from an educational standpoint. I want to help these educators out. And I was still using an older phone that had some GPS technology that I liked, which I gave up, probably about a year and a half ago, but I started with the iPad first, and I had to make the shift to the phone, where I thought the phone was kind of tricky. I don't think it's a mistake for schools to do it either. At the end of the day, it's what schools are doing, whether we think it's a mistake or not. So that's why we use the iPad in the book. So this workshop, as I said, serves as the basis for the book. It's really divided into a couple of different sections, and it's really laid out in the book very similarly. We start by unveiling really all of the access components from low vision, speech, questionable braille, some of the other odds and ends for multiple impairments as it relates to the iPad and all the access tools, which many educators who have been in this industry are not sure how to access them. So that is the first half of the workshop. We get their iPads turned on. We get them not just using the access stuff, but actually performing tasks. So it's not just about gestures moving from one place to the other, but we take a note, we set an appointment, we'll do some different odds and ends using the access components, both low vision, speech. I'll bring some braille displays with me and whatnot. And so that takes usually a couple of hours. And then the latter half of the workshop, as you also will see in the book, focuses on practical applications for the iPad in the classroom. And I really break things down into three different types of categories of tasks that a student has to really do or complete independently. They have to be able to obtain information, they have to be able to interact with information, and then they have to be able to share information. And if you really think in terms of those three components, then you can start to hang different iPad apps on these apps, different categories for completing tasks. So we focus on how to get apps, how to search for the right apps. We focus on using Safari. We do a lot with the App Store and iTunes and Safari and so forth as the first component. And then we segue into, once we have that information, and book reading is really hot right now, so we do a lot with iBooks and Bookshare, beginning to implement some of the Kindle stuff into what we do. There's not a lot of Kindle stuff in this book because when it was completed, it was already well on its way to being printed when all of the Kindle news came out.
That's too bad that the book came out just before, or was just about to come out just before Kindle Access came along. But
yeah, so there may be some addendums and so forth to the book and some updates or whatever. But at this point, that's not covered as much as I would like. Probably the most challenging component of the iOS technology that we address in the workshop as well as in the book is vision teachers who are so accustomed to using note takers. And I think there's always going to be a market for an instant on-off device. But where these devices fall down is when you actually have to share information with sighted teachers, sighted classmates, especially in group projects and so forth. And so we show the different means of editing with the rotor commands and so forth, and the cut, copy, paste, the changing your on-screen keyboards, the advantage to the braille shortcut commands when you're using the braille display. And we really show that although it's different, it's not impossible to create text, edit text, and share text with others. And we focused a lot in the book with Dropbox since the book has come out, because Dropbox is used a lot with schools and universities and so forth as a cloud-based way to share information. I'm also getting on board now with Google Drive and so forth. So the point is, we introduced them to the cloud as sort of the iOS user's best friend as far as sharing information and storing information. I've had to be a little bit more sensitive as to how I portray the cloud. I got in trouble once at our literacy conference when I made a joking comment that thumb drives were dead, and I thought I was going to get lynched by a bunch of vision teachers.
But by a bunch of happy thumb drive users, right?
Yeah, I pretty much had to say, okay, maybe they're on life support, but they're going to be dead.
Yeah. Oh, maybe. Perhaps people are very attached to their thumb drive.
They are. So I've had to learn in my own way how to be a little bit more sensitive to people who are. I think it's a bigger issue than thumb drives. I think we've always been afraid as an industry of change. Change is scary. You know, I came in when, Blazy had a lock on the industry when we brought BrailleNote in, and that was a big change. And now people are in the same place they were when I started with Blazy with their BrailleNotes and Braille senses. Want to use them for things that maybe they weren't designed initially to be used for. And so that's why we have to be sensitive, but we still have to be proactive change agents. And I just, I had a vision teacher sum it up best. You know, note takers are great literacy tools and what have you, but note takers is not what's going to get somebody employed and maintain their competitive job. Not when it comes to sharing information, interacting, and, I don't mean to alienate or offend anybody by saying that, but the reality is in a fast-paced world where you have to do more things than, maybe just basic data entry and so forth, you have to have access to apps that everybody else is using.
Absolutely. And not to take us too far down a rabbit hole, but we just recently did a podcast on HIMSS version 8 firmware for the BrailleSense note takers, and they have implemented Dropbox, and they've implemented YouTube, and they've implemented a way to access an Excel spreadsheet. So HIMSS has realized the necessity for getting on board with this movement that you're talking about that's going on.
And I think they have. And I think if you're going to keep your note taker alive, that costs, whatever now. I don't know. I think that everybody reduced their prices because they were getting beaten up by the fact they were over $6,000. So everybody's closer to $5,000 now. But even so, if you're going to have a $5,000 device, you better keep it relevant. You better keep it in step with what some of these other, $300, $400, $500 products are doing.
Well, when you talk about the vision teachers having to make this paradigm shift, having to learn a new system, i.e. the iOS system, the iPad, learn to use it, learn to teach it. I would assume that this book, the intention of it, is to try to help them bridge that gap or make that leap.
It is, and it's not so much to learn and teach as it is to embrace it. It's not going away, and I alluded to that earlier. No matter what I want to happen, what you want to happen, what AI Square wants to happen, what HumanWare wants to happen, these trends are what they are. And so we better figure out a way to embrace them and incorporate them into not just our own technological journeys, but the next generation of kids coming up who are being put in positions where we're doing all this advocacy work for, more opportunities, more employment chances, and a lot of the things that are currently happening with more disabled legislation in place for disabled people getting employed. We've got to get them prepared. I've always said you cannot have equal rights without equal responsibility. So this makes us more responsible as it relates to interacting with technology, and it teaches us to make our students and our next generation more responsible. And what I tell these teachers is it's not like you have to memorize every single step. Your kids will get it. Just don't get in the way of them getting it.
Exactly.
There's kids that are doing stuff that I can't do. They know more about this stuff than I do. It's like, let's just not get in their way.
What do you think, Larry? I mean, I may be making an erroneous assumption here, but I would guess that the vast majority of these vision teachers that you work with probably are sighted or low vision. I'm sure there are some who are totally blind, but I would guess a lot of them are sighted. So what about this idea that, it's easy for a sighted person to grab an iPad and make use of it, but it's sort of a different ball game with the iPad when you turn VoiceOver on or when you turn Zoom on? How are teachers doing with adapting not only to their own use of it, but to the changes that have to be made for their students to use it. I mean, do you see where I'm going with that?
Yeah, I do. I think teachers are caught up with the headaches associated with the mechanics instead of understanding the underlying principle of the access tool. Those of us who are vision impaired or blind, we don't get the gestalt holistic picture of a screen by looking at it like a sighted person would. So we kind of put those parts and make those parts into a whole. And that's really what these access tools does, from the flicking gestures of VoiceOver to the panning gestures of Zoom. And so if they can really think in terms of parts, you have to have these parts to make a whole instead of this whole that you take in at one time when you look and just touch something and something happens. If you can get your head around that difference, then the mechanics start to happen. If you try to figure out the mechanics before you understand the process you'll listen to, a row of apps as you flick through them, but you cannot take all that in like a sighted person that's glancing at a screen full of apps, is my point. And so I try to position it that way. It's like, think in terms of a different process of accessing this information, and these access tools serve as your way to carry out that process.
Well, you do that in the book, and one of the ways I noticed that you do it is one of the first things you do is really get people to stop and think about that there are three components to the iPad screen. I mean, there's a status bar, there's the apps area, and there's the dock. And so, I think it really helps teachers to be able to break this down, and because it's got to be a little bit confusing to have this glorious, in a lot of cases, Retina touchscreen in front of you, and yet to have to somehow break it down into an auditory modality that your blind student is going to use. I would see that as quite a challenge for a lot of these teachers.
And notwithstanding, even low vision. Low vision might only see part of that dock with Zoom, with the screen Zoom. Okay? Yeah. So the sighted teacher, they don't think in terms of that. They see the whole screen, and they may understand that parts of the screen does different things. They do different things, but they don't think in terms of it as the dock being the four apps along the bottom, no matter what screen you're on. And that's how we think. Okay. That's how that makes sense to you, because you think that way and process information that way. That's difficult for somebody who's sighted to grasp.
I have a sighted wife who I love dearly, and we rarely ever argue, but the times that we've gotten in the most heated debates are her trying to explain something that's on her screen to me on her Mac or her iPad, and me trying to explain to her how to do something about it.
Yeah, and I think that's just in general any computer operating system. My wife and I are the same way. It's like, she thinks I'm talking down to her when I explain it my way, and it's like, no, it's just how I think.
Yeah.
It's not that I'm talking down to you. If anything, I'm talking up to you, because I'm the one who has to break it down into parts.
I really liked, Larry, how you took the reader through a tactile tour of the iPad. I think that's especially going to be helpful to sighted teachers who are going to have to show their blind or low vision students the iPad in a tactile way. I think it's really cool. I really enjoyed that part.
Well, thank you. That process will be speeded up drastically as they show it. The kids will get it. But the reason why I laid it out is because that's how these kids think. And so this book, it is a teaching book, but it's more or less to get the sighted teacher and also the sighted parent. We address parents in there too, because parents want to get this stuff for their kids, sometimes with or without the blessing of the school district. And so the parents need to be on board with this as well. And I think another thing that I point out that I think is imperative is I show people how to lock the screen. Because if you don't lock the screen and kids are flipping the iPad around and you're going from landscape to portrait, then it's like crazy to try to get them to do anything when you've got, my father used to say, it's like nailing Jell-O to a tree.
Yeah. That's quite an image there, Larry.
So if you can stop, you can nail down the Jell-O if you can lock the moving target. So,
well, I would think that, it would be potentially helpful for teachers and parents, at least those who are more geeky, to maybe combine your book with another iPad book that I just finished reading from the people who published the Take Control books, published the Tidbits Press, not related to Dean Martineau's Tidbits.
Right.
But the Take Control people have a really excellent iPad book that is not at all oriented toward disability. It's oriented toward the mainstream iPad user. But it was written by Tanya Angst, who's the editor-in-chief of the Take Control book series, and she's actually been on this podcast before. These books are really very accessible. Again, they're not accessibility-oriented, so she's going to be talking about the iPad as if you were looking at the screen. But sure. But the information is very transferable, at least for me. I get a lot out of these books, but I think parents and teachers, if they were to combine your book with say, that book, they would really have a full idea of what the iPad is all about, both from a disability and non-disabled perspective.
Yeah, I think what you will get from my book is a great foundation. Again, I think there's some things that, you know, people who are vision impaired can glean from it. It was designed for the sighted parent and educator, but I think that, you know, there'll be some things that they'll pick up on as well, the vision impaired reader. But my goal of the book was not to make people iPad gurus, but it was to give them the tools so that they could grow into the device. You know, we talk a lot about different things about the App Store, finding apps, the different things out there, the VIA app and some other things for testing for accessibility. And, you know, not all apps are created equal and whatnot. I want to give people the foundation to know that they can do a lot of powerful things with this so that they can move on to the things like the next book, and they can interact with, you know, their kids can interact and participate in group projects and share information and receive information and search for information and do so much more than you can do with a big traditional note taker. Now, I will tell you one thing that I had to dial down is I'm a very, very, very strong advocate of Braille literacy. And so I had a whole different group of book reviewers who came at this book from different angles. And I really got beat up on the fact that I was initially a little hard on people performing tasks with the on-screen keyboard. And so I had to kind of tone down my stance on Braille, because there might be, you know, somebody who's adventitiously blinded as a teenager or whatever who may not approach Braille the same way I do. So we did soften our stance a little bit on that. Having said that, if somebody's congenitally blind and a Braille user, there's low-cost options out there to really turn that touch screen into a modern-day note-taking type solution.
So are your critics suggesting that the iPad touch screen keyboard is indeed more usable than you were suggesting it was? Or what?
Yeah, and she's probably right. She has kids that were filling out college applications with their iPad keyboard, which I'm not as versed as those kids, obviously. So I toned down my stance a little on that because of her input, for sure.
Yeah, I think what you said earlier is a really great point, you know, that relates directly to this idea, is that if we just get out of the way of these kids, they will make amazing use of these devices.
I mean, who am I to tell a kid that they can't use the keyboard when they can't, is my point. And so I learned a lesson there. It's like, maybe my perspective as a older guy who's always done stuff in Braille, and maybe this kid who is moving lickety split with their touchscreen, I mean, who am I to say they can't, you know? You know, who am I to say, no, you can't do it that way when you're filling out admissions applications to go to college? Who am I to say that?
It does seem like, though, it's your job to point out the different options and possibilities and alternatives.
And I still stand by what I say, is you need either a print or a tactile means of literacy, in my opinion, to be considered what I deem literate. And I won't back down on that. But having said that, if they can do that with a touchscreen keyboard, that's great.
Yeah, there's no substitute in my mind either for the possibilities of Braille and being able to study the sentence structure and the spelling and look at what you're actually, the data you're actually working with. I would agree with that.
Me too.
I know, Allison, that you I don't know if you currently have an iPad, but I know you've had one in the past. What was your take on reading this book from the experience that you've had with the iPad? What did you get out of it?
Well, I have to say that my personal experiences with the iPad were kind of an exercise in frustration. And I think the reason that I didn't stick with the iPad as long as I did is because I had the phone and I figured, well, heck, I'll just go back to the phone. But I really enjoyed the book. I really thought the book was a very nice, thorough overview of how effective the iPad can be for a blind or visually impaired student in the classroom setting. And as I was reading this, I couldn't help but note the similarities between the educational setting and what I am going through as a voc rehab counselor, getting more colleagues on board with this idea that the iOS, mainly the iOS revolution, is changing the face of the technology that we provide to our consumers. And actually, I'm going to be doing a presentation. My colleagues and I are going to be doing a presentation about this very change in the fall at a statewide conference. And I'm just thinking 2-3 years ago, even, we would not have been making such a presentation. My favorite part of the book was the testimonies from the students, because it really brought home the reality of, okay, this is actually a real world example of how these students are using this technology to revolutionize their lives in many ways. And it was just really awesome to read how they are empowered by this technology. So I don't see myself needing an iPad at this time, but I think that partially by having read the book and particularly the testimonies, it may be something that I would be willing to explore more again in the future.
This is my point earlier on. I'm not saying that people won't use both, but I think the majority of working age adults that start with the phone, at least in my experience, they don't embrace the iPad the same way. And so I don't think it's wrong, as you said, Dr. Carter, I don't think it's wrong for us to start with the iPad because it is a different device. But there are so many working age adults who might have a phone. I was just dialoguing with Dean a little bit, who's, grabbed an iPad, and he notices the differences as well about some issues he was having. So I was talking with him. It's a little more difficult when you start with the phone first. And what I run into is, a lot of people who are blind iPhone users are like, well, why do I need an iPad? And I can't answer why they would.
Well, for one, it's a great battery extender for your iPhone.
That's true.
So,
especially if everything's linked up in the cloud.
Yeah, if it's all linked up in the cloud, when the battery's getting low on the iPhone, grab the iPad and just keep on reading your book.
That's true.
I mean, and it really works well in that regard.
Yep.
It also is honestly nice to have that larger screen, in some cases for web browsing. And it's nice the way the screen is divided into different parts. When you're looking at things like settings and so forth, you get a different view on the iPad than what you do on your iPhone. So, I mean, I've enjoyed reading Kindle books and iBooks on the iPad in some ways more, simply because you have so much larger screen real estate to work with.
I agree. Like I said, I started with that bigger screen, so it's difficult for me to understand when I hear things like, well, the screen's too big, I get lost on it, compared to my phone. And I hear that a lot. I don't get that because I started with a big screen. I don't have any research to support this, but I do find that people who have really good O&M skills get around that bigger screen a little better. And I don't have any research to validate that. It's just what I've noticed is my friends with really good O&M skills pick up on that big screen really fast.
Yeah, I mean, you got a point there, but I do understand what people are saying too. It is a more confusing piece of real estate because of its size until you really understand it.
Yeah, and I guess because I started on it, I just got over the confusion quicker, I guess, or I just once I embraced it, then I didn't really see how confusing it was until I dealt with more of the iPhone users.
I don't have any research to support this one either, so I'm just shooting from the hip, but I bet it's easier to go from the iPad to the iPhone than vice versa.
You know, the only tricky thing that I had was to deal with was the actual phone operations. And once I figured those out, everything else was fine.
Oh, nobody makes calls on them anyway.
Yeah, exactly. That was probably the hardest thing for me to do on an iPhone was actually make a call. And besides that, I was able to email and do everything else fine, but actually using it as a phone was probably the hardest thing I had to deal with.
So how do people go about getting this book? I would encourage parents and teachers to really grab a copy of it and make use of it. You know, the summer is a great time to read it before school starts in the fall. How do people go about getting it?
Well, there's a couple of ways. You can always call National Girl Press, 617-266-6160. And first of all, you're able to get the book in two volumes of grade two Braille, standard print. You can also get it as an MP3 file, ASCII, Word, DAISY, or eBraille. The print book is $28, and all the other accessible format copies are $20. You can also go to www.nbp.org, and I believe there's a link to it off the homepage. If there's not, or if they've moved that, you can just put iOS for Success in the search field, and it'll pop right up. You can order it online. You can call, and they'll help you. Again, it's $28 for the standard print and $20 for all accessible forms of media. Online, you're able to choose which version you want. It was a lot of fun. It was a painful process. It took me 3 weeks to write that book and probably about 5 months for us to edit it to what we wanted. So it was not hard for me to put it all out there. It was particularly... I mean, we made sure that we got some pretty rough and tumble book readers. I didn't want a bunch of yes people for reviewers, I should say. So we got some pretty established people who are all noted in the acknowledgments, and they gave me a pretty good beating, that's for sure, along with Diane Croft, who's the editor, who's a really good friend of mine, and a lot of respect for Diane. I call her an honorary blind person because she really gets it.
Yep, she does.
She really, really, really gets it. So
exactly.
Diane was we joke, she was my lion tamer. That's her nickname, the lion tamer. She kept everything even keel and kept things rolling. And it was a really good process for me to make adjustments. You know, anybody who's in sales and marketing has their way of doing things, and it's always the right way. And so I had to learn that my way maybe isn't always the best way for every person who reads that book.
Right.
And that's why I had the reviewers, is I knew deep down that, you know, it's not just the Larry way all the time. As much as I wish it were, it's not. You know, these book reviewers helped me out a lot. And I think with their help and you know, I was happy to be the quarterback of the team, but it was really a team effort from the press, National Girl Press. We really came out with a product that I'm pretty proud of, and I hope it helps a lot of people. And I'm really happy to be associated with the press with this project. That's for sure.
I read the DAISY version, and I read it on the Braille Sense, and I was able to have the best of both worlds, read it in Braille, but also if I wanted to switch, I could have it read with the speech synthesizer on the Braille Sense, or I could actually have it read with the voice that was used to record the, I guess, the MP3 version.
Yes.
And so it's really quite a flexible read, and it's nice that it's in those multiple formats. And I don't know what the legalities of all this is, but is there any chance of turning it into an iBook or an EPUB type book that could easily be read on the iOS devices?
I would like it to be an iBook. I think that's going to be an issue between Apple and National Braille Press. I would like it to be an iBook. I just think that we wanted to get it out before the end of the school year. We wanted to push it hard this summer for next school year. So I think it's something that I can raise again with them. But I think iBook would be really important for sure.
Yeah. Well, thanks for talking to us about the book and letting people know a bit about it. I do hope people will take a serious look at it, especially if you're a parent or an educator, or even if you're just like me. You know, I'm a parent, but my son's in college and sighted, and so it doesn't apply directly in that way. But I'm always interested in learning everything I can about the iPad and accessibility. And so from that standpoint, it's a, for me, it was a book worth reading as well. So I would encourage people to take a look at it.
I appreciate you having me on. It's, like I said, my first time on the Tech Doctor podcast, and I've really enjoyed it. And I want to say thank you for giving us an opportunity to chat about the book.
Thank you, Larry.
You're welcome. And before we let you go, we've sort of fallen into a habit of talking a little bit at the end of the podcast about whatever we're currently playing with that we're excited about or interested in. And so I'm curious, anything that you are really software, hardware, toys, devices that you're really enjoying right now that you're excited about?
I'm fairly tied to a lot of the iOS stuff. I like a lot of the improvements in the new Flexi app. I'm sure you guys use that a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
The Flexi app quite a bit. I think the Prismo updates are really great. My company's involved with a product that's a 12-cell Braille device that I use all the time with my iPhone called Braille Pen. So I haven't really branched out a bunch from the iOS and Braille technology right now. There just hasn't been a lot of other stuff that's really excited me. I think I heard you mention something about those bone conductor headphones. I have played with those a little bit too. You mentioned something about that earlier on in the podcast, so I think that I've played with them, and I'm going to actually think get a pair of those myself.
I think you'll like them. We've really enjoyed the aftershocks, and both the Bluetooth version. I especially like the Bluetooth version, but
the
wired version works well also.
Yeah, I would probably get the Bluetooth one too, but they're pretty amazing how well they work. I saw them also, and they're
not great for music, but they're great for listening to spoken audio and text-to-speech audio, and they're just fabulous because I put them on in the morning, start listening to my many podcasts I listen to every day while I make my coffee, sure. And I can actually hear it when I pour it in the cup now, which is a major improvement over wearing other types of headphones.
Yeah, it is, and I wonder what will happen ultimately as this hardware, you know, the iOS hardware gets better and better. I don't want to open up a new can of worms, but what this will mean for some of our dedicated book readers, because there's new ones that have come out, and you know, I think you get the battery life up and a few more apps out there and so forth. It's going to be hard times for some of the dedicated book readers.
Yeah, once we have the NLS app, you know, it's really going to be, and we have some exciting new apps with like the Voice Dream app, for example, that just really open up a lot of reading possibilities for text-to-speech. And so, I mean, there's a lot to say for not necessarily needing a standalone reading device anymore.
My whole thing is I love to listen to things fast. I'm a fast listener. Even for fun, I like to listen to – I just absorb information fast. So, you know, being able to increase speed as fast as I would like is something I'd like to see in some apps for sure.
Well, you know, someone on a mailing list last week or the week before got into a debate with one of the moderators about the possibility of speeding up iOS devices more than 2 times or 3 times normal speed. And they were arguing that the software was such, the operating system was such that you couldn't do it. And this woman wrote a little app, apparently within a very short period of time, that allowed her to speed up iOS to 8x.
Oh, my gosh.
And, oh, my goodness.
And she said
I would be a happy man if I could get it. And that would make me very happy.
She said that it was understandable at that speed. And so I think we're likely to see a lot more of those kinds of capabilities coming along, because it can already be done. It just hasn't perhaps been done to the extent that it will be.
That's the one thing that's holding me back from going full bore books on. I mean, I do it, but for hardcore, you know, reading, you know, listening to things fast, it, you know, it still isn't there yet.
I can tell you that with the Voice Dream app, I use a Graham on there, and I have been able to speed him up significantly. I think I have him going at 405 or 430 words per minute or something.
Yeah, that's
right now.
Great. That's
yeah,
great.
And he's wonderful. So
yeah, that's really what I need. I mean, that's a good speed to listen to, I think.
I just can't imagine making a very sophisticated British guy like Graham talk that fast.
It's quite different, it is.
I'm sure. I'm sure it is. What are you playing with these days, Allison?
I have a bone to pick with you, Dr. Carter, because I have cracked and purchased the Bose AE2W Bluetooth headphones, and consequentially, you will be sent the credit card bill.
Oh, no problem. Send it right on. I don't mind sending it right back. Wow, so how do you like these Bose?
I love them. In fact, right now I have them hardwired into my Yeti, Blue Yeti microphone. But as far as the Bluetooth goes, it's just amazing to have these paired with my iPhone. It's really revolutionized again the way I listen to things on the iPhone. There's lots of revolutions happening in my life, isn't there? Aren't there? Really, now I have to say I only use my Aftershocks if I'm doing something that requires me to be mobile outside,
yeah,
traveling, or doing things like cooking or making coffee or something like you said. But if I'm just kind of hanging out, I pretty much use the Bose right now.
How much do they cost, if you don't mind me asking?
$250.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's to be expected if they're that good. That's to be expected.
Yeah, I just kind of cringe a little bit when I see that kind of price tag as a voc rehab counselor, you know.
The Bose are the only headphones I've ever heard that sound better when played over Bluetooth.
You know, that's what I've noticed. You guys sound wonderful hardwired into this microphone, but I've noticed even more superior sound quality when listening over Bluetooth.
Yeah, when I went to the Bose store, they were talking about that. The guy that I bought them from was a real Bose aficionado, and he was explaining to me how they worked really hard to work with the Bluetooth compression algorithms to make them really get a maximum sound quality out of the headphones. And he's right. They are amazing. They sound great. And yesterday, I actually took them to the movie theater with me. We have, in our Cinemark theater here, we have what they call descriptive narration available on most of the movies that come here. And so you go there and you ask for a little box that picks up a signal from the projection booth, and in the left ear of your earphones you get the audio from the movie, and in the right ear you get a descriptive narration that comes on and tells you what's happening when there's no dialogue on the screen. And these Bose headphones sound fabulous with that descriptive narration because they're so clear. And,
oh, I bet.
And they block out just enough of the ambient noise in the room so that the sound that's coming from the theater speakers down front don't really get in your way. So it's just, it's really a perfect combination.
Wow.
There's a lot going on out there. We have WWDC coming up on June 10th, where I'm sure we'll hear about new and exciting things from Apple. Last week, Tim Cook was on the All Things D conference. He was on there for an hour and 25 minutes. And I tweeted after it was over, after I watched the video, that it's nice to see that the spirit of Apple is alive and well. And if you really want to see what Apple's up to and get the idea that Apple is still Apple, it's a video really worth watching, with them asking Tim Cook questions and him not answering them, not revealing any more than he's willing to, which is always the way with Apple. But
but
you really see just what a smart man he is, what a clear thinker, how solid he is with his convictions and his beliefs about where Apple is and where Apple's going. So you can watch that actually on the Apple TV if you have one. If you go to the Wall Street Journal channel, the video's on there, but you can also get it from the All Things D website, and I'll put a link into the show notes. So I think that's pretty much it. And I have a cat in here who's in here by accident, who's desperately wanting out the door, which probably means it's a good time to end this podcast and let the cat out of the room here, or let the cat out of the bag, as I say. All right. Well, thank you all so much for a very pleasant podcast here. And Larry, it's good to catch up with you a little bit. And thanks for telling us about the book again. And we look forward to hearing from you again in the future.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
All right. And Allison, until we do this next time, so long.
Bye, everyone.